This week's Torah portion is Parshat Bo, and we're learning, probing the heart and the soul, Hasidic insights into the weekly Torah portion. Today's January 25th at the JCC, and we're going to read from the very beginning of the Torah portion first to understand what the Hasidic author, the Sfat Emet, the same author we learned last week, what he says about the Parsha. So I'm opening up to the beginning of the third parsha of the book of Exodus, Parshat Bo, and it is to be found, let's see here, in chapter 10. Beginning of chapter 10. Then the Lord said to Moshe, "Go to Paro, for I have hardened his heart and the hearts of his courtiers, in order that I may display these my signs among them, and that you may recount in the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons how I made a mockery of the Egyptians and how I displayed my signs among them, in order that you may know that I am the Lord." Now, the simple meaning of these verses is very clear and very straightforward. The simple meaning is that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. God took away, in some sense, on some level, Pharaoh's free will, so that he cannot let the Israelites go. He will not give in. He will not relent. And the reason God did that is so that God will have to continue bringing more and more plagues against Pharaoh. Now, why doesn't God just forget about hardening Pharaoh's heart, let Pharaoh relent, so the Jews will leave? The whole purpose is the Jews leave, so let them leave. Why does God prevent Paro from allowing them to go, so that God has to bring more signs and wonders and plagues so that Paro will eventually relent and let them go? It seems to be circular reasoning. But the answer is simple. And it says it right in the verse. Because the purpose of the plagues is not merely to get the Israelites out of Egypt. The purpose is to make an educational event of it. God wants an opportunity to show his signs and wonders, to do more and more plagues, not merely so that the Jews can leave Egypt and go from slavery to freedom, so rather that God can make a show and illustrate to the world his greatness, his power, his ability, and for that he makes a mockery of Paro, to make a show of him, to make an example of him, so the world can see that Paro is not God, but God is God. That's what the verse says at the very end, in order that you may know that I am the Lord. That's the pshat, right? That's the simple meaning. But that's not the way at all, that the Sfat Emet, Rav Yehuda Leib Alter of Ger, that's not the way that he understands the verse. In order to begin understanding the way that he understands the verse, we'll first make some linguistic comments and we'll read his interpretation. So the linguistic comments I want to make are as follows. When it says in the English we just read, "Then the Lord said to Moshe, go to Paro, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his courtiers, in order," well, that Hebrew word "in order," lema'an, can mean other things in addition to the English "in order." In context, that's what it means. But our Hasidic Hasidic rabbi will understand it differently. That's point number one. Just keep that in mind. You can like pencil in that those words "in order that" may mean something else. The other linguistic comment I want to make before we go on is about the word "signs." Signs. Then the Lord said to Moshe, "Go to Paro, if I have hardened his heart and the heart of his courtiers, in order that I may display these my signs." The word in Hebrew there, "signs," is "ot." In the singular, "otot" in the plural. I'll put that on the board if I can. Aleph, Vav, Tav, Ot. The word means a sign in the sense here of a miracle and a wonder, right? But it could also mean, as I wrote on the sheets at the very top, it could also mean something else. It could mean signs in the sense of indications or hints. It could also mean letters. An Ot is a letter in Hebrew, an Ot of the Torah. Like when you go to Chabad and you buy a letter in the Torah that the scribe writes, that's an Ot. You buy an Ot. So the word Ot
can be a sign in the sense of a wonder, and it can be a hint, and it can also be a letter. And that triple meaning is going to play a role in what our Hasidic author is going to say. Ready? Here we go. So on the back of the page is the photostat from something that our author, the Sfat Emet, writes in this portion. Again, as I said in the past, I'm getting my translations from this wonderful volume that translates a small portion of the Sfat Emet, Art Green, The Language of Truth, put out by JPS, Jewish Publication Society. I'm reading. Here we go. For I have hardened Paro's heart and the heart of his servants, so that I might show these my signs in his midst. Right? That's what the verse says. Says the Sfat Emet. Rashi notes that might show seems to indicate the future. That's what Rashi says. And of course, that's the pshat. Because in the verse, God says that I hardened his heart so that I'll be able to bring more and more plagues. That's future, that I will bring tomorrow, the next day. But says the Sfat Emet, though it could refer to the past as well, he's going to understand that it's not that God hardened Paro's heart so that in the future God could bring signs, wonders, plagues. Rather, God hardened Paro's heart because in the past God brought signs. And that's what I said earlier, that the word that's translated in the text as in order that or so that could also mean something else. He's going to interpret that it means because. Not so that in the future, but because of something in the past. God is hardening Paro's heart because of something in the past. We're reading on. All these deeds that were done in Egypt, all the plagues and all the wonders and all the and the taking the Jews out of Egypt took place because God had already placed in Egypt hidden treasures that Israel still had to take out. What does that mean? It's not that God is doing what he's doing, hardening Paro's heart and everything else, in order that God could do his signs. It's rather that God is hardening Paro's heart and doing everything, including the plagues, because God had already put signs in Paro that the Israelites have to take out. What does take out mean? He doesn't explain. He's playing with words in Hebrew. It's very, very suggestive and beautiful. My signs, otot, refers to the letters, the same word, otot, through which heaven and earth had been created. What does that mean? So there's a Jewish tradition that says the world was created with 10 statements. Ever hear that? Mm-hmm. Right? And even if you never heard it, it appears in Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, even if you never heard of it. By the way, I referenced it on the first page. Everything I'm going to say, I basically wrote in shorthand on the first page here. Even if you never heard that the rabbi said that the world was created with 10 statements, you know that in the story of Genesis, the world is created through divine speech. Now, speech, of course, is made up of letters. That's the word ot. So let's read the sentence again in our author. My signs refers to the letters through which heaven and earth had been created. Okay? So what does it mean? God created the world through speech. Speech is made up of letters. As if to say God created the world with letters, and those letters are in some sense still embedded in the creation. The letters are embedded in the creation, and again, the Hebrew word for letters is ot. God's letters, the tools that God used to create the world. the bridge between God and the world, the letters, they're somehow embedded, latent in creation. And when our verse in the Torah says that Paro hardened his heart in order that, or because, that he will, or he did, right, future or past, put these signs in Paro's midst, it means that God is hardening Paro's heart and doing everything he's doing because of these letters of creation that are in Paro's heart, in Paro's midst. Paro here represents the world, the evil of the world. Even in the most evilest people of the world, there are embedded in them, within them, the letters with which the world was created. Now, what does it mean in a deeper sense? I'm trying not to give everything away, but to say step by step. What it means is that when God created the world, he left fingerprints. He left fingerprints in the world. And those fingerprints, the otot, the letters of creation, those divine fingerprints can be found every place, even in the most evilest place, even in Egypt, and even in Paro. Even Paro bears witness in some sense. If you do the right forensic investigation in finding the fingerprints, even in Paro you can find hints and traces of divinity. I said hints and traces. The word ot can also mean hint. So God is doing everything he's doing in Egypt because of the signs, the letters, the hints that God left when he made the world, and he left them even inside Egypt. And the purpose of Judaism, as he's about to say, as he said already, is that Israel has to take out the signs. What does it mean, take out? Well, he's using a word from the Exodus, to take out of Egypt, but what it means is that the Jew has to find the fingerprints and has to make them apparent, has to take them out, has to highlight them, has to make them clear to the world. Let me stop for a second and use a verse from Psalms to explain what I'm saying. So we're going to look in Psalms, and the place we're going to look in Psalms, I have it on the sheet I prepared, is Psalm 19. Near the bottom of the sheet I prepared, it says, let's contrast this approach to the opening of Psalm 19. So we're going to open up Psalm 19. And as soon as I find it, I'll tell you what page it's on.
1126.
1126. Thank you very much.
1431.
Psalm 19. Here we are, Psalm 19, page 1126 from the beginning. It says, for the leader, a psalm of David. The heavens declare the glory of God. The sky proclaims his handiwork. Day to day makes utterance. Night to night speaks out. There is no utterance. There are no words whose sound goes unheard. Their voice carries throughout the earth. Their words to the end of the world. This psalm, which by the way is in the traditional Shabbat morning service, near the very beginning, believes, has an approach, that the heavens declare the glory of God. That is to say, the psalmist says, you look at the sky, you observe the stars, you see the beauty of a blade of grass and the fragrance of a flower, it declares its creator. There cannot but be a creator to this beautiful, magnificent, intricate world. You probably don't expect what I'm about to say. This approach of the psalm is not what our Hasidic author is saying. It's not. It's similar, but it's not the same. The psalm says that in a very, very open, automatic, transparent sense, the heavens declare the glory of God. Says the Sfat Emet, the heavens don't declare the glory of God, they whisper it. And you have to listen. It's not that anyone who looks at the world sees God. That's what the Sama says. The Sfat Emet, writing in the 19th century, says, you know what? It's not that simple. You could look at the world and not hear any declaration of God's creation. The world, actually, says the Sfat Emet, is mute. And it doesn't speak. It doesn't declare the glory of God. But there are fingerprints of God. There are otot, there are signs. But if you don't look for them, you won't find them. It's not apparent to everyone. You can't say to someone, don't you see the world was created by God? It's not apparent to the naked eye. It's much, much more complicated than that. God put these signs, as it were, embedded in the universe. But they're only signs, they're only hints, they're only footprints and fingerprints. It takes a lot of work to discover them. A lot of forensic effort. And according to the Sfat Emet, the purpose of Israel is to take out the signs. To take them out means bring them from potentiality to actuality, bring them from latency to being obvious. To do the groundwork, to make the effort to find divinity, even in Egypt, but it's not so easy. It's not so easy. And then the next line says in the Sfat Emet, the children of Israel who were ready to receive the Torah first had to bring forth words and letters that already existed in the world. So, first of all, he says that we have to bring forth the words and letters that already exist. That's what we're talking about. We have to bring forth God's fingerprints and show them to the world. That's our purpose. But what's more interesting is that word first that he uses at the beginning of a line. He's indicating that there's a certain priority of action. That before we can receive the Torah, we have to first bring forth the words and letters that already existed in the world. What he means to say is, I think, is that there are two levels to the religious life, and one has to take priority. There's the religious life of doing mitzvot and observing the Torah, and that's wonderful, and that's fine, that's obligatory, and it's important. But before that, there's something else. Before that, before the literal Torah and the individual particular mitzvot, there's the universal actions and mindset and effort of looking at nature and finding God in it. And only after you do that is it time to go to the mitzvot of the Torah. You first have to find God in nature, and then you can find God in the Torah. That's certainly not a position taken by all Jewish leaders and authors and teachers and rabbis. But that's what he's saying very clearly here. First do the work of discovering God in the woodwork. And then go to Torah. That doesn't mean, of course, that you should neglect Torah. But it means that in your mind you should know that there's something prior to Torah. Search for God in nature. And it's hard work. It's not easy. Look for the footprints. Look for the fingerprints. Look for the otot, the signs that are embedded in the universe for those who know how to find them.
But you don't think, Rabbi, that would be difficult for a person that is just growing up to look in the world for that hint when they don't know what to look for, when they don't know what to expect?
Good
point. You
don't
think it will be difficult?
Good point. He seems to claim it's something that every Jew should be able to do without prior knowledge. You don't have to know what you're looking for, you have to know that you're looking. But I understand your point, I really do. Carolyn?
For me, that doesn't seem hard. I mean, when I look at the things around me, the universe, the trees, the sun and the moon and all the things, the way nature is, to me that is just so miraculous. The child being born, it's just so miraculous to me. I think that's easy.
You say like the psalmist. That says the heavens declare the glory of God.
Today you, but what about when you were 10 or 15?
When I was little, I also sort of marveled at those things. I don't know why, but...
So you are born with it.
Very good. And that's really true. She said some people are born with it.
We seem to be jumping. First, the last 10 minutes, you were telling us there are hidden messages and in the codes.
I shy away from the word messages and codes.
Well, I mean, right? there is something that the average person doesn't understand. You have to have a certain degree of knowledge, a certain degree of intellect. So where I quarrel with Carol, I just don't think anybody here in this class, unless they have studied like you have studied, and you are telling us this is all new to you too.
Wait a second.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood.
The Sfat-Emet claims you don't need to study theology, you don't need to study mitzvot, you don't need to study Torah in order to search for and find God in nature.
I agree.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
It is work. For Carolyn, it's easy, and that's good, right? I'm not criticizing that, God forbid. But for many people, it is an effort. And let me explain something. The Sfat-Emet is living in Poland, as we discussed last time, in the last three decades of the 1800s, the 19th century. It's a time in which secularism is growing. Judaism is losing members of the faith by leaps and bounds, right? 1870, 1880, 1890 in Poland, in Warsaw, the city's being secularized, young Jews are leaving the Shivot and going towards secular literature, the Bund, as Stephanie mentioned in the last class, and the Zionist movement is becoming more secular, the Enlightenment. And it's hard to claim that all of these Jews that are leaving behind God, it's hard to say the heavens declare the glory of God, all these people are blind. Because if Carol Ann, if her intuition is universal, then all the world is blind. Why don't they see it? He's claiming, our author, Sfat-Emet, they're not blind. They're good people, but they're not doing the work that's necessary to find the sparks of divinity that are there.
I would have had a harder time if I had been in Poland during the late 1800s. I would have not had probably such a marvel.
Right, you merit to live in Christian Texas, where everyone sees God behind every rock.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm still struggling with the opening portion of this hour, where we're talking about the hidden meaning in the message that God was given to Pharaoh.
No, we didn't say anything like that. No, we have to be careful how the Sfat-Emet is creatively reinterpreting the verse. He's saying that these otot, these signs of godliness that remain from creation, they are even within Paro. When the verse says, like we can read the verse again, the verse had said, in order that I may display these signs among them, among the Egyptians, the way the Sfat-Emet is reading it is that because I have already displayed these signs among them. Millions of years ago, I displayed these signs among them, among the Egyptians, even in Paro, even in the darkest culture on earth. I've displayed these signs. I put these signs there. And now, everything that's happening now, that I'm hardening his heart, and I'm taking the Israelites out of Egypt, and I'm creating an Israeli people, a Jewish people, is in order that you take these signs out of the hidden places where I put them, which means in order that you make them obvious to the world. You show the world that there's godliness in everything, even in Egypt. Even in the most impure and lowly and dangerous places, there are hints of godliness. By the way, see the connection to what we did last week, which I'm moving towards. So now let's read on. This is the next paragraph in the way the English translated what we're reading on the sheet I gave out. Right? On the sheet, we're in the third paragraph. And it says, thus the Midrashim say that originally there were just seven mitzvot. He seems to be changing subject. We'll read on and explain. Only when Israel came along did they merit receiving the entire Torah. But, I think that's a mistranslation. Change the word but to something else. The word should be, I think, in the same way. In the same way, first they had to clarify the light of Torah that already existed within the natural order. So again, take the word but and change it to in the same way. Mimi, do you need a sheet or is there one on the table there?
She has one.
Okay. So let's read it again from the third paragraph. Thus the Midrashim say that originally there were just seven mitzvot. That refers to the Jewish tradition that before Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, before Moshe, before the Torah, the whole world had upon them, incumbent upon them, seven mitzvot. The Sheva mitzvot b'nei Noach, the laws of the Noahites. Everyone heard of the Noahide laws? Anyone not heard of them? Heard of the Noahide laws? And in Jewish tradition, the way it goes is that we say that God gave six laws, not seven, six laws to Adam, and then to Noah, he gave a seventh. And then there were seven. Who knows what the seventh one was that Noah got? It's explicit in the Torah.
Take a guess. I have one out of seven chances of being right. Thou shalt not steal.
No.
Honor your father.
No, no, no. Besar benafsho bedamo lo tochelu. Don't eat the blood of a living animal. That is explicitly given to Noah. So six to Adam, one to Noah, that makes seven. So the way the tradition understands it is it's a gradual process of adding mitzvot. First there were six, one more makes seven, and then was added on at Sinai a number of others, so we get to 613. A gradual process of revelation. The reason that our author, the Sfat Emet, starts talking here about the seven mitzvot and then Israel getting more mitzvot to get to the entire Torah is because he wants to show that spirituality is a gradual process. And then he says, remember I'm replacing the word but with the words in the same way, first they had to clarify the light of Torah that already existed within the natural order. In other words, now it should make sense. Just like we couldn't get the Torah, the 613, until there was first the process of six and then one more, and then the 613, so, in what we're talking about now, you cannot really keep the Torah in the deepest sense until you first did the work he's talking about, of discovering the otot of God in the universe. It's a gradual process, just like the 613 build upon the 6 and the 1 mitzvot, so the 613 build upon the prior legwork that you have to do of going yourself into nature and into Egypt and discovering there, ferreting out, uncovering, unearthing the divine footprints in the universe. It's a matter of religion being incremental, being progressive, going from one stage of development to another stage. And you can't have the 613 till you have the first 6 and 7, and also you can't have the 613 until you first have the universal religious work of finding God in nature, claims the Sfat-Emet. And in nature means all place in nature, even in Egypt, again, which symbolizes the darkest of the dark. Then he says, I'm going on and reading from the text. Then he says, this is the way of the world that preceded Torah. You cannot understand that without the Hebrew. Does anyone know, have you heard the phrase in Hebrew, Derech Eretz?
I've heard it, but I don't know what it means.
Okay, Derech Eretz, you would translate as Menschlichkeit. You've heard of Menschlichkeit? Meaning proper ethical behavior. Derech Eretz means proper, basic ethical behavior between human beings. Menschlichkeit. And there's a statement in the... where is it? Someplace in the Talmud. I can't remember where. I think it's in the Ethics of the Fathers, but I might be wrong. That Derech Eretz Kadma LeTorah. The way of the world, Derech Eretz, Menschlichkeit, basic human reality, is prior to Torah. Prior to Torah. You can't go and keep Shabbat and fast on Yom Kippur without first being a good person. First you have to be a mensch. And on that basis, you should add the mitzvot of the Torah. Why does the Sfat-Emet say that now? Because it's the same idea of talking about the incremental nature of building a spiritual personality. Just like you need the 6 mitzvot and the 1 and then 613. And just like you need Derech Eretz, Menschlichkeit, and then the 613, so you need what we've been talking about. So you need the basic groundwork of finding God in nature, and then the 613. The incremental building up of the religious experience. I'll read that again. In the same way, they had to clarify the light of Torah that already existed in natural order. Clarified means, like we said, to find the fingerprints and make them apparent. This is the way of the world that preceded Torah. It's another metaphor that just like Derech Eretz precedes Torah, so this also precedes Torah. It is something impressed within nature itself, and you have to discover it. Always, one must first set right the physical and the natural, and only afterwards can we come to new insights. Now, I want to tell you the Hebrew word that's here translated as set right. Because you're going to be surprised. The Hebrew there is letaken, tikkun olam. You recognize the phrase, tikkun olam, letaken olam, to set the world right. Now, when we use that phrase, we almost always mean physical actions in this world. We almost always mean clothing the poor and feeding the needy and healing the sick. We mean making the world a better place in a physical sense. The Sfat-Emet is not using that expression in that same sense. He's saying that one must first set right the physical and the natural, and is referring to things we just talked about. That is, he's using the phrase tikkun olam not to mean making the world a better place, but rather tikkun olam in the spiritual sense of going into nature and seeing, realizing the godliness within it. That's his tikkun olam. It's not a physical act. It's a spiritual act. It's one of consciousness. And he's saying that that conscious, that expanded religious consciousness that you create is a foundation for the rest of religious life, as we've been saying, for the rest of the 613. So his tikkun olam is a spiritual, personal, inward act, and it's not an external act, at least in this particular passage. And I want to get back to that in another few minutes. Now scripture explains why God did it in this way, placing my signs in Paro's midst. Now remember, what does it mean, my signs in Paro's midst? It means that God's footprints are even in the most impure places. Why did God do it that? Why did he put his signs even in Egypt? when they clarified the lights that came out of such a place, they would go on to live and shine throughout the generations. Now the word clarified here means to make latent the fingerprints. The word is latent? No, to make obvious. Make obvious the fingerprints. To do that physical, I take it back, to do that spiritual work of making God's signs and wonders that are in the universe, making them obvious. When they clarified the lights that came out of such a place, right? When we take out of Egypt all these signs and put them on bulletin boards and show the world that there is godliness and there is truth, there is signs of God, His footprints and fingerprints, even in the lowliest of places, they would go on to live and shine throughout the generations. That seems to mean that if our forefathers do this spiritual work, later generations benefit from it. Every generation builds upon the insights of the previous generation. And if our forefathers show us God's presence in every place and the divine signs in every place, then that stands for future generations. It stands, in other words, it's there for us to benefit from. And apparently he's saying that future generations don't benefit from it unless the prior generations did the work. And what I mean to say is that had God's signs and wonders, His otot, His footprints and fingerprints, been so clear that you wouldn't have to work to find them, then they wouldn't have as great an effect upon us. Do you hear that? It's like no pain, no gain. If you get in a silver platter, it's not really yours. You don't appreciate it. When you have to work for it, then you really have it. In the same sense, if you just walk outside and say, God's presence is so obvious, it doesn't really penetrate. Only when the presence is not obvious and you have to work to find it, then does it become really something that you own, something that you make part of your own personality, something that you really absorb and identify with. No pain, no gain. So why did God put His signs in the universe in such a hidden fashion? So that we'd have to work to find them. And when you work to find them, then they become really meaningful. And meaningful not just to you, but to future generations. Therefore, the verse goes on to say, so that you will tell it in the ears of your children and your children's children. This made into something that would last. And that's what the end of the verse is, right? That this whole thing is, I'm going back to the verse, in order that you may recount in the hearing of your sons and your sons' sons, I made a mockery of the Egyptians. Right? The whole thing is for the future. God put His signs there so that they can be discovered. Just wait a second. God created the Jewish people in order that we discover the signs. And if we do the work, the hard work of discovering the signs, then our sons and our sons' sons and our daughters and our daughters' daughters will have it as an eternal, lasting spiritual legacy. But if we don't do the work, they won't have it. And on the other side, if it wasn't work that had to be done, if it was just obvious, it wouldn't really be as meaningful. Bruce.
I understand what inner consciousness is. But how do I, who somehow found this inner consciousness and found the beauty, how was it conceived that it would be passed on to the generations if it is just in me?
That's a wonderful question. And in order to highlight that question, I brought our next source. And I didn't tell Bruce 50 minutes ago, please say that at this point.
You did.
But don't tell them.
How much did he pay you?
So we're going to look now. We're going to go back to other things, but since Bruce brought it up, you actually could have waited 3 minutes. This is a translation of two books of Rabbi Nachman Mibraslav, another Hasidic luminary. The book we're going to look at is called Sichot HaRan. Ran is Rabbi Nachman, the R for Rebbe and the N for Nachman, Rabbi Nachman. Sichot HaRan means the Sichot of Rabbi Nachman, means the talks of Rabbi Nachman. We're going to look at the very, very first essay in the book called The Talks of Rabbi Nachman. I'll just tell a short story how I got to know this piece. Some of you might remember that perhaps I've said in the past, that I used to teach in a Hasidic yeshiva in Israel. I taught there for 5 years, I think. It was called Yeshivat Bat Ayin. And in the Bat Ayin yeshiva, Chabad Hasidut, and especially Bratslava Hasidut, were really the main foci. Now, I taught in yeshiva not because I knew Hasidut, but rather because I wanted to learn Hasidut. They hired me because I was a good teacher, not because I was a Hasid. But I was very happy to teach in a Hasidic yeshiva in order to learn Hasidut. So sometimes I would sit in classes that my students were taking to learn about Hasidut. And once upon a time, I was teaching the beginner's program in yeshiva, and I realized that I wanted my students not just to hear about Hasidut, but I wanted to get an introduction to Hasidut. So I said to the Rosh Yeshiva, why don't you teach for my beginning students an introduction to Hasidut once a week? He said, fine. And I sat in on the first class with my students, and the essay we're about to read is the one he taught in the very first class of an introduction to Bratslava Hasidut. So, and it's exactly what Bruce said. It's exactly what Bruce said. It begins on the sheet I gave out. The wisdom of Rabbi Nachman, in Hebrew, Sichot HaRan. It's on the verse from Psalms 135, for I know that God is great, our God above all others. These are King David's words. You see the place, everyone? These are King David's words. I know. That's what King David said in the Psalms. I know that God is great. Says Rabbi Nachman, I alone, for the vision of God's greatness cannot be shared. As Bruce said, you may have a vision, but even with yourself, you cannot share it. Sometimes spiritual insight is so elusive. It's like a flash of lightning. And you certainly cannot communicate it to your son or your daughter. You can't even communicate it to yourself. It's gone after a short while. And the only way to recreate it is to re-experience it. But remembering it doesn't work. Today you may be inspired and see a new light. But tomorrow you will no longer be able to communicate it even to yourself. I know. King David said, I know. But it means only I, as I am now. It's only me and not anyone else. And it's only the I that exists this moment. Because another 5 minutes, I'm a different I. I'm changing every moment. For the vision cannot be brought back. The Rebbe said, as Rabbi Nachman said, look at the next verse in Psalms. All that God wants, He does in heaven and on earth. That's the next verse. It's a different thought, speaking of something else entirely. King David says, I know, and can go no further, for words are no longer adequate. In other words, he's saying that after King David says, I know that God is above all others, the next verse goes to a different subject, because there's nothing else King David can say on that subject. I know, but I can't communicate what I know. I can't say even to myself what I know. It's just a momentary flash of insight that has to be renewed every moment. Our perception, next column, of God cannot be communicated. It is so lofty, higher than high, that words cannot express it. It is written, a verse from Proverbs, her husband is known by the gates. That's the verse that we sing on Friday night in the framework of Eshet Chayil. And one verse there, near the end of it, says, her husband, the great woman, her husband is known in the gates of the city. And the gates of the city, that's where all business took place. That's where the court was. He was a great man. He sat at the gates of the city, fine. But the Kabbalistic interpretation, and he brings the Zohar to bring the Kabbalistic interpretation, the Zohar states that the husband is the vision of God, which each man perceives through the gates of his own heart.
the heart is hidden and the gates do not open to another. So if you go to the verse, her husband is known by the gates. And if we are the woman talking about her husband, so her husband, and that symbolizes, according to this reading, a vision of greatness, a vision of God, is known only through the gates. I think that means the gate closes every moment. Like a gate is something that is momentarily open, and you catch a vision, but then the gate closes, and the vision is gone. That's the nature of spiritual insight, claims Rabbi Nachman. So, when I studied this with my students, that is to say, when I was listening to my employer and teacher and colleague and mentor teach us a little bit of Rabbi Nachman's insights, the purpose was to show how Hasidut especially puts a premium on spiritual insight, a premium on the individual, the autonomous, personal understanding that you alone can come to and must renew every moment. Every moment is a spiritual challenge. That's what we learned then. That's very powerful. But in the context, we'll bring it right now. Why did I bring it? I brought it to show the contrast between Rabbi Nachman and the Sfat Emet. The Sfat Emet seems to say that these spiritual insights can be preserved and communicated, whereas Rabbi Nachman says they can't. It's personal, completely and absolutely personal. And indeed, Braslav HaSidut is extremely personal HaSidut. Do you know that all of the Hasidic dynasties, they have a leader that's passed on from generation to generation? Chabad is a leader, and all the other... the truth is, today, Chabad doesn't have a leader. But usually, by definition, they do.
They still have the leader, he's just not with us in this world.
Okay, so I think that means they don't. But Braslav HaSidut believes there should never be a leader. Since Rabbi Nachman, there's been no leader, it's not supposed to be a leader. And it's part of the fierce individualism of Braslav HaSidut.
I can't get past the fact that he says the husband is the vision of God.
Don't take it literally. Don't be offended by it.
Yeah, offended.
It's a Kabbalistic image. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do we as students ever get the word? How do we understand this? How do we take the inner consciousness that we should all have and make the world a better place? If each one of us has a different idea of the inward act.
Good point again. I can see a few things. And they're all true, even though they sound contradictory. One is, perhaps we need not assume, as you assumed, that we're supposed to make the world a better place. I understand where you got that from, right? I understand. But in Hasidut, it's not necessarily about make the world a better place. It's really about the spiritual insight. It's about the inwardness and not the outwardness. I don't mean it's only about the inwardness, right? Then it wouldn't be Jewish. But there's a great emphasis on the inwardness. But secondly, let me say, and again, this sounds contradictory to what I just said, but it's not. Secondly, let me say, perhaps the spiritual insight is making the world a better place. In the sense of people who live with an awareness of God's fingerprints in the world, they live in a different world than people who don't see that. And at least in theory, going back to the cookie and the Weight Watchers in the previous class, when anyone was there, at least in theory, living with that insight changes you. It absolutely changes you. And it changes the world. But it's not the direct type of feeding the poor that you have in mind. It's absolutely not. And remember certainly that the Hasidim in Poland in 1870, 1880, 1890
until 1904. I think the Sfat Devanta died in 1904. They were not involved in directly and overtly doing what we call Tikkun Olam. They were not necessarily involved, certainly not primarily, in feeding the sick and making the world a better place. They certainly didn't see part of Judaism as overthrowing the Tsar and making the government more amenable to Jews. It was an inward tikkun. We talked earlier, right, that they used the phrase tikkun for the inward act. And that changes you and eventually, in a global sense, changes the world you live in, but not directly.
But listening to this, it makes me feel that they wanted to segregate themselves from the rest of the Jewish people.
Anything I said indicates that?
No.
No, I didn't.
No, but what the movement wanted to segregate themselves. They did not want... I understand what you're saying, but I find it very difficult to fit it in with anything that we understand on an everyday level in our life and society.
Hasidim did not want to separate themselves. They wanted to, and they are today, in every place you go, they want to try to bring Jews into...
But what Bruce is saying, just the last class, we talk about follow the commandments and doing what the commandments is saying, and mm-hmm. it's all about external. You know, mm-hmm. you do something for you. It's external. You do it, the commandments. And here, understanding Bruce is what I'm understanding, if I'm understanding him, that he's saying that it's more something about internal, without placing the world that I need to do the commandments for them. I'm doing it for me.
Okay, so let me respond. Yeah. Very good.
Yes.
Certainly, not all of you in the previous class, some of you are. Certainly, I say this all the time, it's the subject of the previous class, today and next week. The center of Judaism is the commandments. It's the external, it's the doing. Yes. But Hasidut, without denying that, indeed tries to add a deeper level Hasidut at the same time that it doesn't repudiate the commandments, God forbid. Mm-hmm. It would be Christianity if it did. The early Hasidim were accused sometimes of repudiating the commandments, but mainstream Hasidut doesn't repudiate the commandments, but it adds to the externalities of Judaism, the very important externalities, it adds the inner element. And this work we're talking about now, this personal work of finding the fingerprints and making them clear, that is the spiritual work of the Hasid. The Hasid is involved in tikkun olam, in changing the world in the spiritual sense. It's changing himself. The Hasidim, let's take the Hasidim of Poland in the time of the Sfat Emet, 1870 to 1905, they were not involved in tikkun olam in the external sense. They're involved in doing mitzvot, but they weren't involved in government and changing governments, and they weren't involved in Zionism. They weren't involved in making the world a better place in a physical sense, in a direct, immediate physical sense. They were doing their tikkun olam inside. Now, to just mention these matters of separatism, the Polish Hasidim were not separatists. The Rebbe, the Sfat Emet, saw himself as the leader of all the Jews of Poland, even though many other Jews didn't see him as that, but he tried to unite for certain, but at the same time he also tried to protect his Hasidim from wayward influences, protect them from the secularism that was encroaching upon Warsaw, absolutely, protect them from secular newspapers, protect them from secular Zionism, that he did try to protect them from, absolutely. You know, I want to say one more thing before we end, which is the following. I want to see the connections between what we learned today and what we learned last week. This is important to me, because I want to make a certain correction in things I said last week. We talked last week about that metaphor of conversion. Remember, Abraham and Sarah, they converted the people around them. to monotheism and for the Sfatimet, that was a metaphor for finding the sparks every place and uplifting them. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So please understand that finding the sparks and uplifting them is the same thing as what we talked about today. Finding the footprints and the fingerprints and make them lit. It's the same thing. It's true that last week I explained it differently, slightly differently, because last week I talked about the fact that I didn't say last week that it's a spiritual inward act of finding the godliness, of finding the souls, and pointing out the godliness highly. I didn't say that. What I said more last week is I talked about finding the truth in different places, in different ideas, in different political parties, and pointing out that this is true and that is true, and bringing those truths into Judaism. It's all the same. It's all the same. It's just different stages. The first stage is the personal, spiritual, of seeing God's signs and footprints in every place, that the whole world was created by God. And another stage is, a bit more practical stage, is seeing godliness and truth in different ideas and different political parties, like Rav Kook did, as we talked last time about seeing godliness in Zionism, seeing godliness in Darwinism. That's another stage in the same idea of lifting up the sparks. But it's two stages in the same basic idea of the Hasidic work of finding godliness and goodliness and truthliness in every place and everything, even within the culture of Paro, which represents the most dangerous and the most impure places on the earth. And let's end where we began. That music might be another example of this. That it's not just seeing that God created the whole world. The next stage is taking pieces of the world that seem to be impure and bringing them into Jewish culture of holiness. So that's the Kirtan Rabbi, if you will, who takes this ancient Hindu music and puts it to Hebrew words and says we can use that also for our service of God.
Rabbi, the Hasidic movement was after the Christianity starting to spread out?
Yeah, the Hasidic movement begins in the 1770s in the Carpathian Mountains in Eastern Europe, and Christianity began 1,700 years before that.
So that can be that they were understanding that other meaning of Christianity and bringing it back to Judaism?
That's a very good point. In a certain sense, although not consciously, Hasidut was taking a little bit of a Christian idea and bringing it back to Judaism, the idea of spirituality. Mm-hmm. That there's more to Judaism than just the mitzvot. Christianity got rid of the mitzvot and emphasize its spirituality. Hasidic movement tried to bring that spirituality, some of it, back to Judaism without repudiating the mitzvot.
Yeah, that like we learned before, that there are stages.
Stages.
So stages that you are growing and you are growing. And for example, today we already know how to handle nuclear energy, when 50 years ago we couldn't. It's the same. So that means that tomorrow there is something that it hasn't written yet about Judaism and how we are going to be changing?
Absolutely could be. That we say that there are 70 aspects of Torah, right? There's always more to be found, more to be uncovered.
So this new movement, that is not new, but it has been growing and growing and growing, that is drawing people from Christian churches out of the Christianity to this messianism, that they are calling messianism. What would be the lost link between them? What would be that they are drawing everybody out? Christianity in general, in Judaism in general, and they are trying to merge together. What could be the lost link, if it's any, or if it's something wrong?
Do you mean what good can come of that?
Yes. If any.
That's a very good question.
So what will be the next step? You know, because I'm checking the Hasidic. I don't have any doubt. Of course, I am not I'm not a bad person.
I just realized that I have